Hello everybody and welcome to this week's .NET Community Stand-Up, ASP.NET Edition, or the ASP.NET Community Stand-Up as I like to call it. We have a guest!
Yeah.
My very good friend, Mr.
David.
Fowler.
Yep.
David Fowler,
professional. And of course, our friends online, as always. All right, John, before, let's just get into the community. Like, you love the community, let's just do it.
Let's just do it.
Let's get this puppy back on track.
All right, let's share some desktops. Let me know when you see this business.
Hello.
Yeah? Sharing away, so exciting.
Can you push that button? Yes, look at that. Look at us with professionalism.
Hooray, okay, so first of all, going through our weekly dose of Shahed's awesomeness. Here he's going through A through Z, so we're up to IIS hosting of ASP.NET Core web apps. So again, one thing I love with these is he kind of pulls all these random things together. There's how do you do in process? How do you set up IIS with a VM and all that? So it's all kind of pulled in together here. So some things here explaining, you know, some basic important things, the difference between in and out of process, setting up for actually installing, turning on the features for IIS. It's easy to get kind of used to just doing IIS Express. I recently had to go through and set up with IIS, you know, the full IIS for something, and it's kind of good to review what's in here. Another thing that I find, you know, as I'm teaching people and you know, just going through this in classes and stuff is some of the Visual Studio features. So obviously, like the IIS profile he's explaining here. And the difference, this is another, you know, of course, launch settings and stuff. And the difference also in, where do we have it? In the actual, if you're launching under Kestrel or under IIS. So that's also a key setting there.
So there's something we're considering for version 3. Let me put our little face up in the corner. David would very much like if we changed the default in Visual Studio for ASP.NET Core 3 apps from using IIS Express to using Kestrel. And it is a point of contention, like with something that we've been throwing back and forth. And I'm like, that's great. Someone put together a list of all the things that will be impacted by doing so, and we can either fix them or decide that it's a good idea or a bad idea based on that. And I haven't seen that list yet. I know some of them off the top of my head, but I'm interested in other folks. Like, I'm interested in the viewers' opinions of that. So we won't stop the flow. People, please share your opinions in the chat. What would it mean to you? Do you have any opinion on whether if we would change the default hosting option of Visual Studio for ASP.NET Core 3 apps to be Kestrel directly, so it launched your app as a console app, effectively, the server, and launched the browser as well and all that type of stuff. Do you have an opinion on that? Move on, John. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting. I personally kind of would like the Kestrel approach, just to have it the same everywhere and stuff, but yeah, so please sound off in the chat. So I've actually broken today up into a few little sections. One is on hosting, one is on Blazor, and then some kind of general tips and tricks stuff towards the end.
We're hearing a echo now?
Yeah, that's how the camera came in to ask us something about the restream thing. But it's all good now. So.
All right, so first of all, Mr. Shane Boyer writing about the Docker extension for VS Code and .NET Core. So this is cool. This is an update for the Docker extension in VS Code and with some nice things, like for instance, generating your Docker file, integrating with Azure Container Registry for pushing. So, you know, a nice kind of quick overview here with animated GIFs and stuff, which is exciting, and showing actually pushing out to, you know, app service on Linux and stuff. So very cool. The Visual Studio Code extension. And
we're getting a lot of air noise, by the way, on somebody's mic. That must be.
That's me. I had this last week as well. I think it's not air.
Hot.
It's just mine's quite low. I think it's noise whenever one of us moves.
I gotcha.
Sorry.
Okay, sorry.
We won't move.
All right. Please continue.
Okay, so Scott, this is one you sent me yesterday. This is hosting ASP.NET Core on Heroku with Dockerfile or with Docker and CircleCI. So this is kind of cool. This is using a free instance of Heroku. If you, in the case here, just wanting to share something with a friend, right?
So yeah, this is Ibrahim Sutta, who is does work in ASP.NET Core, and I was poking around on his blog.
Yeah, and this is very cool. He links over to a full project on GitHub, and then as well some gists as far as like Dockerfile and stuff. Mm-hmm. So yeah, very lightweight, setting up with CircleCI to build and deploying it out. So as he points out here, a great use case is just, hey, you want to share something with a friend on a free instance or something. Demonstrate. I've run into this sort of thing too, like say in a dev team, you know, and you just want to coordinate with a designer and a developer or something. So cool. Here, this is a really, just a nice short tip from Anuraj, and this is showing using the save data header with ASP.NET Core. So save data is a new, but generally supported thing for, you know, as they point out here, Chrome, Opera, Yandex. You'll see this a lot like in your mobile browsers. If you're on, you know, something where you're on a metered connection, then if the save data header is present, then you can serve lighter weight data. So the example here is using middleware and showing, you know, lower quality graphics if you're on a metered connection.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, very cool. And so, you know, this is a kind of simple example, but you could do something where you toggle over to completely different views or whatever. So,
are they actually using a library to change the graphics? They are. They're loading, like, different bitmaps and, like, stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
This is an example. I would think you would actually want to resize the graphics and have, like, separate folder or is that, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, pre-processing would generally be
better.
Well,
and this is where you want to consider some of the Vini libraries that are available.
I mean,
and services that will also do caching.
Yeah, or an edge cache that will do that for you and process on the fly.
Services.
Is that system.drawing?
Sure looks like it, yeah.
So I can't let it go. System.drawing is not recommended for use on servers. I'm sorry to everyone watching who is using it on a server. It is documented, especially on Windows. I believe the version, is that system.drawing?
Yeah, why is it copying into the memory stream first?
A good segue into David's stuff. But before we get into the intricacies of using streams and pipelines and buffers and reuse and stuff, generally speaking, system.drawing on Windows has some rather, unfortunate traits that make it not particularly good for using in server applications, like taking system-wide locks.
That's so tactful.
And so it is documented not to use. Now, the version that works on Core, I believe on Windows, it still uses all the same GDI goop. So it's still like, be very cautious and like just be warned. The version of system.drawing that works on Linux, I think uses like some mono stuff, doesn't it?
Skia Sharp,
and that's
I believe.
Is that have that same problems or is it better? Is it fine? Okay, so I actually don't know what the modern guidance is, but my understanding is that library isn't actually officially supported either.
I've just been using Image Sharp lately.
System.drawing is not released as part of the shared framework. It's not really.
No.
It's in the Windows compatibility pack, and so it has a different support policy. If it works for your app, wonderful. Eyes wide open, couple of caveat emptor things to be aware of when using system.drawing. And I would take this opportunity to spruik the wonderful, what's the one, ImageSharp?
ImageSharp, yeah.
Great library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Cool. Yeah, I think in general, as far as the pattern, like there's a lot of things we would do different. Like I would never do this anyways as part of the middleware itself, right? Have pre-cache and all that stuff. But the safe data feature is pretty cool to know about, like supporting that, just plugging in middleware. So cool. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Very cool.
All right.
Oh, grid view.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So Vaktanji showing here a virtual grid view. So the nice thing with virtualization, of course, is you're only rendering what is actually in the viewport. So you're optimizing for that. So that works well for things like where you've got, you know, many thousands of rows or that kind of thing. So I'm sure we've all, you know, we've played with these. Yeah, I remember going back to writing, you know, custom ones with web or WinForms and stuff, right? So, so good stuff. And of course, all the code is out here looking at. Ooh. He's doing some interesting things too, as far as JavaScript interop to handle both the scrolling, the actual scroll wheel stuff, and then also what is actually in the viewport, what is actually visually. Or visible at the time, right?
I tried to write a virtualized data grid in WinForms once.
Did you fail?
And I gave up. It's possible. Like this is
super hard.
It supports it. There's all these hooks. It is not trivial.
You still have a custom drone control.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
Win32.
Cool. So Chris Sainty writing about building Blazor apps using Azure pipelines. So this is actually building out a build process for a Blazor application. Showing here he's using a free Azure pipeline. And a few things that he ran into, he's actually using the Windows build agent. He said he ran into trouble using the Ubuntu version, so he's switched it over to using the Windows image. Yeah, so here we go.
You've trained him well, Scott.
I am very careful whenever Scott is on a call to say Ubuntu.
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 Oh, God.
There you go.
I still tell the story about how David Fowler, I showed him video of Nelson Mandela saying Ubuntu. And David said, I don't believe it.
Cool. So here we've got, you know, just using this image and the build script and configuring the artifacts. That's something I've run into recently is getting your artifact publishing set up is very important. So, and all the green checkboxes. So that's wonderful. Okay. One of my favorite posts over this past week. From Dustin. This was on the front page of Hacker News. This is tips and tricks for ASP.NET Core applications. I love these because it's a roll-up of opinions. These are things that Chris loves to do, and you may disagree. There's actually great discussion in the comments as well. But so some things here. Turning on logging, getting the logging set up exactly how you want it. So things like enriching your log entries. And then going down some, you know, customizing things like your output. There's config classes. This is great too for strongly typed config as well, right? Then going down some things like conditional configuration extension methods. So here he creates a when extension method, and then he's able to do this. He can say when in development, when this, and have this kind of chained approach.
Wait, so is that okay? Scroll up a little bit. I see. I believe you have one built into the stack, actually. I think it's a map when.
What?
I think we have something built in that does this already. Map when. Map when, I think. And it takes a lambda.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Is there a difference between, because map branches, is there a difference?
Lambda's branch.
Is a difference between this, which is just doing a local evaluation and then adding it to the middleware once versus branching?
When.
They're different, right?
Use when?
Which is, is this?
Pretty much, I think.
Okay.
Pretty sure.
That you're getting into one of the little, this part is a little.
We have all these features.
The edges of middleware construction that very few people use, branching and rejoining. Like whether you add a middleware to the pipeline or not, like which is what I think this is doing, doing immediate evaluation in line and then building the pipeline versus branching the pipeline based on a predicate. Those are two very different things.
Yep.
Right.
And so these might be different, but is there a use when?
There's a use when.
There's a use when which does this.
Not quite.
Wonderful. Not quite. It's different.
It still branches, but it.
But it rejoins for you.
Same effect. Yeah.
Same effect, but it does it differently.
Yep.
There you go. Now you have three options.
Great. Okay. Cool. And see, this is the kind of thing where getting into this, then you like find out about these features where it's like, I've never used that. So
is anyone in the chat using branching? Leave a comment. I'd love to know.
Everyone in the chat, by the way, said Kestrel.
I know, we were looking. Yeah.
Like not even, it wasn't even the same. Like it wasn't even close.
No, but we, you know, selection bias here.
Kestrel
well.
That kind of represents our customer base.
Selection bias.
Selection being people who are on the internet.
The 200 people who are.
The people that.
That follow our antics every week.
An hour, exactly.
Exactly.
So some neat things here just towards the end of this, exposing a version endpoint for your APIs. This one's controversial. I don't know. I mean, some people really care about this, but you can actually remove the server header for Kestrel if you want, right?
Well, I mean, if you're trying to get, you know, 7 bytes and you can't find it.
Wait.
It's more for privacy,
server,
right?
The server header is required by the spec. So is my understanding.
Yeah.
You can't not have a server header by the spec. The browser doesn't care.
The one that advertises?
Yeah,
I've seen people try and do this for security as
I've
well.
I've seen it for
right?
the banks like that
do.
Obscure their attack.
They do, but then all of our reports we pay for that tell us how many people use ASP.NET on the internet don't work. So don't do that. How else are we supposed to know how successful we are?
How's Damien going to buy another watch if you're going to...
He won't get fined.
My goodness, you went there. You went there.
Yeah. So what's nice to hear, what tips and tricks do you have? And there's a lot down in the comments. One cool one that I thought was neat is we get a call out here from Muhammad saying, hey, a lot of this stuff is in .NET boxed. So I've been doing these talks lately, this ASP.NET Core 1 Hour Makeover, and I love this sort of thing too, where it's like, hey, let's throw some opinions in and talk about them. So one final one I wanted to point out from this guy named Scott, and here he was digging around in David Fowler's GitHub.
I'm guessing. Don't let him near your keyboard.
Showing some of this stuff, David. So yeah. I'm not going to dig through this post. I just wanted to say if there's the, you know, this is out here in case you want to actually.
The larger context here was just that you can see lots of fun stuff when people are poking around, right? You can see cool things that people are working on, spikes that they're doing. It was a learning exercise for people.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. I'm done.
I mean, it's very much like David is in real life. He has no filter. And when he's coding, he hasn't. It's just all on GitHub. You can just see everything.
That's the issue.
I'm surprised you don't just live stream your keyboard at all times. Just see whatever.
Since we're open source, I make more public things now. I mean, back in the day, I just had a thing on this that was just a bunch of projects.
I'm interested in that because I often think I should do that whenever I create an app. But I'm like, oh, I have to create a repo.
It's backup for me.
So what do you do?
How do you do it? Push from like VS from like so. I make a project, web application 785.
But it has the horrible layout you don't like.
Then I fix it in place, then I push it.
So you fix it like source folder, move the solution, you do all that manually every time.
Yep.
And then you you create a git init locally, and then you go to the GitHub and you create a repo, and then you push to the remote.
Yep.
And you do that every time. Doesn't that take like 15 minutes?
If it graduates from web application 147 to a real thing, I'm like, oh, this is good enough.
Block in my brain that's like, that will take me like 10 minutes.
So I don't bother.
Yeah, it's about 10 minutes. I just want a button that says, make this on GitHub now in VS. Can someone make that extension for me? And then I will do what you do.
Good idea.
So, David.
Yeah.
Every time I can't remember the right order to do stuff, so it's like create the repository and then there's a git ignore up there.
No,
or there's
never.
Or I make it, or I git init and then I add the remote locally and then I push and I
That one.
Like, which one is the right one?
The second
one. Create repo that's naked, has nothing in it. Copy an old git ignore from your local folder on some other
project. And git attributes.
And git attributes.
That's the problem. Do we have a .NET git ignore?
Yeah, but
global
you won't believe. Yeah, it's called Visual Studio. It's not called.
It's like circa 2020.
Grab the one from our repo. Grab the one from the ASP.NET Core repo. That's what I do.
You lost
tacky.
Me right there. That's stupid.
It
feels tacky. Right?
We should fix that.
We need a .NET git ignore global tool.
But this was similar to the new .NET thing I wanted to build, right?
Yes.
I always find this mental hurdle of like, I have this thing, I just spent 4 minutes trying out an idea, and now I want to put it on GitHub. Even ignore CI builds and pushing to my git and all that stuff, which would be amazing, but I just want to get on GitHub and have it structured well. I go, I can't be bothered, I got a meeting now, or whatever it might be. Or I hit Scott's thing, which is, crap, I did it the wrong way. And now I have to start again, or I took the good repo name and now I have to delete it.
Worst part is renaming a project doesn't rename the folder.
Yes.
So you have to rename the project.
That dance.
Edit the solution file to make it the right name.
You have to open the solution file in like Notepad.
That's what I do.
And like, you do that every time?
Yeah.
Can someone please make an extension that can just push a button? It doesn't help the layout thing.
If refactoring worked, it would be better.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. Hey, I just found a .NET git ignore global tool.
See? Mm.
And it's yummy.
Does it work well? Is it good?
Yep. It's super huge. It's like 5K worth of things to ignore. Everything you could possibly want to ignore, NuGet packages and props files and just all kinds of crap.
Props files you may want to ignore, though. I'm not sure you want to ignore those.
I just put it in the chat.
Okay, then.
All right.
Very cool.
What do I have to show?
We have a guest. We're going to like show some stuff.
So I have a giant notepad of just stuff that I'll just show in some order.
Is there a theme?
Yeah,
is
so the big thing is performance.
Okay.
So there's performance and there's new features.
Do we care about performance?
Yeah. That's all we care about.
Okay.
I'm kidding. It's not all we care about.
Do you want me to show your screen now then?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I have a bunch of stuff. If you guys can see this zoomed in. Performance. So in 3.0, I'm sure Damien showed this on a previous stand-up. Here's our, is this visible? Like, can anyone
see
this?
I can see colors.
Pretty good. So it's mostly green.
It's a giant notepad.
Look at that. I'm zooming and it's like, it's trying to resist me.
Oh, Power BI rescales as you zoom the browser.
Oh, super clever.
Yeah.
Which means it's not. Okay, so.
Well, you need to use the Windows Zoom.
Can I?
Windows Zoom works.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Is that good?
Windows Zoom works.
Oh, wait.
Wow, that was good. That was really big.
So in 3.0, compared to 2.2, we made big strides going from.
It sucks. Zoom jacking.
Yes. Yeah. Zoom jacking. What a term. That's great.
Perfect.
Yeah. .com.
So we went from 3 million, is that even right? That seems kind of high. Wasn't it 2.9 before?
We have a bit of fluctuation in the 2.2 runs, so it goes from 2.9 to about 3.1, depending on like the temperature of the room or something, I don't know.
So the goal is to get around 4 million, we're hoping, at least for 3.0. Mm-hmm. Before this was 2.9, 3 million. So we had a big improvement, and there are a bunch of changes that are responsible for that.
I should just quickly point out, for those who have been tracking our Tech and Power progress, this is not the top number that we report on Tech and Power. We have another test that is even lower. This test uses middleware statements and stuff.
So we do have the platform benchmark.
Yes.
Which doesn't cheat, but it basically is.
It's Kestrel Direct.
It's Kestrel directly. So it's Kestrel and our parser for HTTP.
It's no DI. There's no middleware.
There's a host.
And you can see that the on the left here, we have the black line at the top. That's the platform in here we go. This is the platform test. And you can see it has even ticked up a little bit in 3.0. But the green line, if you can just move the cursor so we can see the full history, there we go.
You can see
where it went from 2.2 to 3.0. Yep. That was about, and I'm trying to use your mouse now, is about there, I think. That's where we took the runtime change. And what we're trying to do is make those lines as close together as possible. In the ideal world, there would be no cost for using ASP.NET Core on top of Kestrel. But we're making really, really good progress. There is a dip there. There is a very visible recent dip.
Something happened this morning.
So we need to go and investigate that.
Yeah.
But as David said, we're trying to get to the 4 million line, which would be amazing.
And hold it.
Yeah. But the platform test is 7 million. That's what you see on Tech and Power. That's the one that maxes the 10 gig network, and we need to figure out how
So we think if we get 4 million, we'll be faster than Nginx.
So
for that test.
Explain to me like I'm five. What is the business, in quotes, that is happening that effectively cuts it in half?
Are
you copying memory, marshaling things, serializing
things?
There's
just more
bookkeeping
things that get run.
So 50% of bookkeeping, 45% of bookkeeping?
You won't believe how much those things affect this kind of test.
And remember the black
line. I believe it. I see a chart of it.
So just to remind folks, the black line represents saturating 10 gigabit networks sending Hello World. Right? Yeah. Sending Hello World is kind of the most inefficient thing you can do on a network.
Oh, yeah.
So we're sending 15 or 16 of them together. So we do get up closer to a proper packet size, like an MTU size.
Yep.
But it's still, you know, horribly inefficient, really.
Are you in the benchmark, like getting on packet boundaries and MTU boundaries? Like,
we've done the 16 requests to flush the entire payload.
Yes.
Okay.
Unlike the ASP.NET Core example, the
right
doesn't do that.
Yeah. So because of the nature of the platform test, because you're basically writing a custom, you're using HTTP parser. You're not using a full application
framework.
There's
no context. There's no objects.
You can write code that's custom for the test. You can say, I know that there are going to be 16 requests, and I will not flush
until all
of them are received. And then I will send 16 responses, because that way you know you're going to get the most effective packet size usage. A web server can't really do that unless you have configuration knobs and configurable buffers and all those type of things to do that. Yep. And to be fair, some of them, Tech and Power, do. Some of those servers do allow you to configure those things, and they do when they submit them. And I'm happy to say that ASP.NET Core middleware is usually faster than all those anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're doing a pretty good job.
Okay, so let's look at some of the changes responsible for those improvements. So. First change, I'll go through. We now in Kestrel we use the HTTP request response and context on the same connection.
The actual objects.
So before we used to allocate an HTTP context per request, and I made a change in 3.0 to reuse those objects per HTTP one connection and per HTTP two stream. So for one HTTP connection, requests can't overlap. So you have one request at a time. So now we just reuse that object over and over, and that was a huge improvement for reducing allocations and actually help throughput overall.
So here's a silly question.
Yep.
Is it the actual allocation or the garbage collection that eventuates when you allocate that costs?
So it's
that's
funny.
The saving.
We spend tons of time talking about allocations, but allocation is actually super cheap.
Right.
It's actually pretty much a pointer bump.
but collection is where it ends up.
So it's really about avoiding any garbage collection.
And
as
the funny
much as
thing
possible.
Is, these tests run for such a short time, they don't even like trigger the DC for the most part.
Right.
So like sometimes these optimizations like have other impacts that, that help performance, but it isn't just the allocation that, that makes it better. So for example, this was a dot memory profile before the changes. So we allocated a default HTTP context, default HTTP response, a request services feature for the request services, and a form feature for forms. This request didn't have any form parsing, so it's kind of weird to see a form feature here allocated. Also, it's showing a queue user work item callback default context, which I'll talk about in a little bit. This is where there's an enum showing up, being allocated, and enums are structs, so it shouldn't show up here, right?
Is that a candidate for the longest type name in the framework?
Queue user work item,
and it's
callback,
and it's generic.
Default context of object.
That's pretty long.
It's pretty long. I don't know.
I didn't see anything longer on that profile.
It could be the longest on this actually. Yeah, on this profile.
That is long.
So we had basically a profile of what the allocations were like in 2.2 before these changes in 3.0. So we had the context, a bunch of strings for headers, the request, the response objects, a form feature, a bunch of callbacks. Somehow an enum is showing up. So me and Ben kind of went to work on this profile to try and get it down to just strings, just the headers.
Ben Adams.
Yeah, me and Ben.
So this just sounds like a natural extension of our pay-for-play mantra that we've been trying to have since ASP.NET Core 1.
Why allocate a form feature if this is a GET request?
Right.
Right. That kind of thing. So this change reused the HTTP context on the same connection. So before we had 81 megs, I think this was, I can't remember how many requests I did. For the same workload, here was 81 megabytes of allocations. And this is dot traces timeline view because dot memory is actually broken on .NET Core 3 for now.
Oops.
Yeah, oops. Stuff changed, stuff broke. It's being fixed, I've been told. So you can see here we had 15 megs of context, 15 megs of requests, 15 megs of response. And the goal was to get rid of that completely. And if you look at the new profile, it went from 81 megs to 46 megs of allocations.
Nice.
So 46, and there we're seeing what we have left were strings for headers and request service feature and the form feature, right? So that was part one, get rid of the context allocations. The second part was to lazily allocate more things. So the form feature, and the funny thing is a bunch of these required breaking changes in quotes, because they won't affect the masses of people. And so if you were getting really deep that you would actually see a breaking change. So this change made the form feature lazy. Before we used to allocate the form feature up front to set options, and now we pass those options all the way down to the form feature so that whenever it gets accessed, it then is read. So this change actually helped improve CPU as well because we were doing less up front. Right, so for GET requests, never allocate the form feature. And I think I have numbers somewhere.
Now, since you're doing the same work, is it like how does that actually save work? Is it just by waiting in case, like pessimistically, if something fails, you don't process it? Or,
yeah, so,
you know what I mean?
So for the form feature specifically, there's no need to allocate a form feature if there's no request form body. Right, so before we used to allocate a form feature every request.
You did that every single request?
Every single request up front to set options.
Okay.
And it was a kind of a design issue where anything on the HTTP context that requires services, we had to pre-allocate because there was no way to flow state all the way down to those features. And now we have a way to do it that we've invented in 3.0.
Now, from our web forms heritage, we know that every single web page has a form.
Every single page has a form. Right? Every single request. So it went from 60 megabyte allocations. You can see this picture here, 60 megs of allocations of the form and the request services feature down to, wait, is that the old one? This is the new one, sorry. So after this change, I think we only had two allocations. It was the request services feature.
You're moving really fast.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so here's the change after we did the form change. And the sad part is I don't think it was the same number of requests. So it's 60 megs, so you kind of compare it to the previous results. But
we'll take your word for it.
The throughput got a lot better too. It went from
well, then it must be right.
It's much, much better, right?
No side effects.
And we do have our perf rig. I'm not sure if I can show it, but see if it shows up here. Sebastian made a beautiful UI you can use to run performance tests if you're if you work at Microsoft and you're on.
You just like broadcast that IP address to the world. It's internal. It's not mattable.
That UI is what we use to verify our changes. So I'll make a change in the PR. I'll get the bits from that PR. I'll upload it to this server, and it will download those bits, run the perf test, and verify our changes. So I can verify perf changes on our CI, on our actual like, perf rig, and paste them inside of a pull request to see the changes.
At least that IP address is documented now.
Hey, so a question came up in the chat, which actually it caught my attention too. Yep. 500 exceptions, what's going on there?
So whenever you disconnect from the benchmark, all the connections drop off, and that triggers all the exceptions. And I found an interesting perf thing with exceptions I won't go into now because it sounds terrible. All right, let me hustle through this list.
So smooth.
Oh, yeah, I know. The next one, the next change to look at is to, today we, when you want to get per request services, there's a feature on the HTTP context that's called request services. We used to have a piece of middleware in hosting that would pre-populate that field eagerly. So if you ask, if you never asked for request services, it was always there and allocated. The goal here was to remove that completely. So we figured out a way to make it as lazy as possible, which also reduced allocations even more. Although those are mainly used for real applications, for the benchmarks, it makes a huge difference. So I believe we went from 24 megs of allocations in this benchmark, in this particular benchmark, and they were all for the request services feature. There was 5 megs of that. And we ended up going to 19 megabytes. From 24, so a small change, and now we were at a place where the thing being allocated every request in the default case is strings. So if you look at this profile, string is like the vast majority of allocations. No more stragglers, anything else. We do have these byte allocations, and I'll talk about how we got rid of those like later on. All right, so far we got the per request allocations down. Now we're gonna look at more esoteric changes. So WebSocket improvements. We used to do a lot of copying for WebSockets. We used to copy bytes from the TCP connection stack to a request-based stream. And now we basically do a thing where we're reading bytes directly and exposing those bytes from the connection pipe into the actual application layer. And we saw a perf bump in Sigmar because of this change. So you can check out this change. It's a small change in Kestrel. To basically for upgraded requests, and an upgrade request means requests that are a pass through to the actual underlying connection that we just read from the actual connection level pipe instead of copying bytes into a request pipe. So that helps save a bunch of memory as well. There's a new interface in the BCL that you will probably never use for the most part. Does anyone use the Threadpool API? I'm talking to the audience that's watching online. There's an API called QUserWorkItem, and you use this API if you want to, you know, offload some work to the thread pool. The issue with the API, well, there's no issue, but the issue that we had was every time you called QUserWorkItem, it would actually allocate a work item. People don't think about that normally because there's an overload that takes a state object. So normally you call QUserWorkItem, you pass in a delegate to call back and some state. And the state object is there to avoid allocating a closure when you're actually passing your delegate to user work item. In this model, you actually implement an iThreadpool work item, and you call unsafe queue user work item, and it will run your execute method as the callback. So instead of passing in a delegate, you pass in an iThreadpool work item. And we took advantage of this in ASP.NET Core to do a bunch of cool things. So we no longer allocate per HTTP2 stream. We no longer allocate in the IIS case, we don't allocate per request anymore to dispatch requests to the thread pool. And there's one big change that we made in the scheduler in Kestrel. So Kestrel has a scheduler for IO. We basically batch thread pool work items together into one giant work item and then run that on the thread pool. And Ben made this change that we had planned for a while. And it was basically to implement the iThreadpool work item interface on our scheduler interface on the scheduler in the actual sockets transport, and we ended up making our platform benchmark literally zero allocations.
After it started.
So this was sorry.
Like you have to allocate something to get to the point you can do one request.
Objects, the per request overhead is zero allocations.
Right.
So we literally allocate nothing per request. It's all reusing bytes, reusing state because of this change.
And also, just to qualify that, we .NET as a platform allocates, as a framework or as a runtime allocates underneath you. Like yep. it does preemptive allocation
yep.
or aggressive allocation. But when it comes to the code that's running in your benchmark,
in your benchmark,
the server that the benchmark is using, then after a connection is established, we can run as many requests, infinite requests on that connection, and it literally allocates no more memory.
Yep.
Now, some of those things are shared buffers, like you said, and if you add more connections, then we might have to grow buffers and things, and that obviously is an allocation. So it's just important to understand the context of when we say no
zero allocations, doesn't allocate anything.
Right.
Does some of your investigation into allocations, does that any of that end up like going back down into the stack where you're like, hey, yes. we're allocating too much?
All the time.
Yeah, a lot. So the iThread pool workflow interface came from me looking at an allocation profile. I'm going, why is the Q0 work item user callback like the number like underneath the HTTP context? That is super high. That's kind of weird. Oh, we're allocating every time we like read bytes from the network. Can we get rid of that somehow? And then it takes some design work to figure out how to do it in a way that is like not damaging to the actual stack. And so that was a big change.
Well, so part of the reason I'm asking that is how like. Some of this is just crazy interesting in terms of like, hey, we all use Kestrel and we all use ASP.NET and we like want to see it all run faster, but also stuff that I can do in my own application code. Like this benefits me as an app developer too, right? If I'm using those things.
Yep, so you, if you were dispatching work to the thread pool, you could today remove the allocation by implementing your own iThread pool work item. And you can reuse those items. So that's a benefit of this interface.
Cool.
This is one of the Ben Adams crazy changes. So I sent Ben a performance profile from one of our runs, and it turned out for a 100-byte response, we were zeroing out 400 bytes of stack space. So we have this method that we, so in Kestrel.
Wait, so now we're not even talking about heap allocations.
Yeah,
when we say allocations, we generally mean the heap.
The heap, yeah.
Now so we're talking about stack.
Yeah, so this is.
Which
this,
we never think about.
Never, yeah. So and we figured, so we have code in Kestrel that assumes a bunch of known headers, and we copy bytes from those known headers into a buffer really quick, really fast, right? And we even have a specific order in which we copy, assuming that those headers are more common than other headers. So we have common headers, less common headers, least common headers in different kind of batches, right? Mm-hmm. And what we did was we generated a giant switch statement that said, for these set headers, just copy the bytes over. But it turns out we had to reserve a bunch of variables on the stack for all these like known headers up front. So it turned out the JIT wouldn't optimize anything because it couldn't store anything anymore in registers. So Ben, looking at a profile and looking at the JIT dump, decided to turn our crazy unrolled loop into a loop with a bunch of go-tos.
Go-tos? Go-tos are awesome.
Go-tos
are pretty crazy.
Go-tos are amazing.
We ended up making a switch in the very end because we didn't like go-tos.
Really?
Yeah. So instead of allocating a bunch of variables per header, we now have a bunch of variables set once, and we just kind of assign those variables to the header to be written every time, instead of having a giant set of locals on the stack. So those are fun changes with the perf stuff.
Someone asks, what's the advantage of enqueuing work directly to the thread pool? Because you're showing queues or work item or whatnot, instead of using task.run. This gentleman didn't get it.
They do the same thing. So there's
more infrastructure involved with tasks. There's its own scheduler and blah, blah, blah,
so
blah, blah.
So task.run has more overhead. You have to allocate a task. That's one downside.
Right.
If you don't care about waiting on the result in line, there's no point in doing task.run. Task.run also behave differently to queues or work item, where task.run tries to, okay, so this is super, a little bit deep. So there's two queues in the thread pool, a global queue and a local queue. The queues that are local are per thread. So when you call like task.run or continue or schedule a continuation, those are preferred over the global task.
So if we could draw.
If you could draw like
we would draw
a bunch
like
of boxes,
a box
right?
for each
we're,
thread.
We're both threads.
And then there'd be another box, which
queues,
is a global one.
There's a global queue
okay.
that John and
hang on,
Scott
we're gonna do some interpretive dance to show everyone this.
So there's there a bunch go. Of threads. So there's we're threads.
Okay.
And we have our own queues.
Okay.
So you're running on my thread. I'm running.
And I'm running too.
And then you can run. And then
I'm pulling stuff out of my queue.
Someone calls task.run.
Okay.
On my thread.
Okay, John calls task.run.
Yeah, and then
on your thread.
And then you call queue as a work item.
Yeah, boom.
That goes into the global queue. And then I'm
here's
like,
the global queue.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I'm like, I'm going to read from my local stack first.
Okay.
Before looking at that queue.
I see.
So my work gets preferred over that work.
Okay.
So task.run, you can your work is preferred over the global
does
queue.
Does queue use a work item going to the global queue or the thread local
by
queue?
Default, it goes global. And,
oh.
and you can pass in a prefer local flag.
Interesting.
Saying prefer local or over global.
Interesting. Okay.
So if you're doing like a producer consumer,
yes,
where I want to give work, I want to produce work on one thread and have a different thread pick up the work.
Right.
You want the global queue
all
because it's more fair.
So if you use task.run,
aren't you guys still running? You guys
yeah. So like
running. My queue got empty and I finished all my work.
Then you can chill out.
You didn't throw me more work, John. There we go. Now Scott's running as well. We've got three threads. Thread injection just occurred.
Yeah.
Can we simulate thread starvation or is that
it
like
is coming up on lunch? That's starvation.
Thread starvation. You got my joke before I got it in. Oh. All right. Let's go back to.
All right. Some more fun stuff. Some new features in Ethernet Core. There's generic hosts everywhere. We started work in 2.1. We added this thing called the generic host, and it was basically we figured out that if we wanted to have more app types use our cross-cutting concerns like DI and configuration and logging, we need to have a generic host that works, you know, across multiple app types. And we had the web host, and we figured we should make the web host deprecated and have the generic host be the main thing. If we could go back in time and we did, you know, .NET Core instead of Ethernet Core first, we would have like the generic host from the beginning. So we're kind of retconning it back into the stack now. So,
okay.
So every new project now has the generic host as.
We love all the stuff we did in ASP.NET Core 1 and 2, and now
so
we're
much.
Sharing
we're pushing
it, with
it everywhere.
Other app types.
Sharing?
I think there is even a.
Forcing
a,
it.
There's even a sample app that doesn't exist anywhere except on Glenn's computer
that
runs WinForms in the context of the generic host, which means every new Windows form that gets created is DI from our container.
Yeah,
and it was actually not hard to do at all.
Super easy.
It was actually super easy. So there you go.
So generic, yeah, that's everywhere. We should talk about the worker template. I guess Glenn should talk about it in detail. But
did we do a thing on that already?
Did
I showed
the,
it last
the,
week.
We did, we've
okay,
it
perfect. Okay,
yeah.
good.
And I showed the gRPC template.
Rigid components. It's a new thing. The template in preview 3 is actually super nice.
Yeah.
It's not one project, not two projects anymore.
Oh, for Razor components.
Yep.
Yeah, one app. Yeah.
That part's kind of nice. Okay, so the more changes. We have some C# 8 reactions to features. So our DI container now supports IA sync disposable. It's actually a pretty interesting thing to support, where if you have a service that implements IA sync disposable, you want it to be disposed, right? Asynchronously.
Mm-hmm.
There are some issues though, because it's kind of viral. Everything up the stack has to be async disposable.
Right.
So at
both
the very
async and disposable.
Yeah. So at the very top of the stack, you have to call dispose async for the async disposables to all like run.
Okay, and so now I guess at the top of the stack, we always just call dispose async now.
Yeah, today, yeah.
And that means you can now get into the world of
sync
over async really easily. Because anyone who had been doing previously async work in their synchronous dispose and was just going, I'll just do dot wait, which itself is bad, but they didn't really have any other option. Now we've got this support, we've made it even potentially worse.
Not well.
Because then you end up with async over async.
So you can call synchronous dispose from async dispose. That's fine.
Okay.
The issue is
that's
you,
fine.
Yeah.
If no, you, I'm talking about the other way around.
The other way around's not fine.
Yeah. But people, you can imagine how people will land there now.
Yeah.
And so we have actually changed the invocation path of dispose from from our host to now be async, whereas before it was synchronous.
Yep.
That is something to watch out for in 3.0 apps.
Yeah.
I would say.
And the other thing, the other hole is if you have a service that only implements IA sync disposable.
Mm.
And someone control the host called dispose, it'll throw an exception.
Oh.
Saying I can't dispose async things in the container.
That's nice and opinionated.
So since our template does dispose async, you don't see it for the most part. But if you control the host yourself and you call dispose, it'll say I can't dispose an async disposable thing.
Cool.
The other change, I think enumerable now, we had support in Signalr. So Signalr supported streaming from client to server and server to client in 3.0. And we just added support for iasync enumerable. So in your hub, you can now return an iasync enumerable and use the beautiful yield syntax in C# 8 to just return async things. Super clean. What else do I have? What else can I show? JSON, we have new JSON across the entire stack. There's a reader, a writer, and a DOM. DOM being like JObject, a loosely typed object model for the JSON schema. And a serializer just got checked into preview 4, which is going to be coming out, who knows when.
Sometime after preview 3.
After preview 3.
Which will be out yet. Imminently.
we're going to move JSON.NET out of the core. I think you spoke about this before.
Yeah, there was a blog post last year, and I've talked about it on here.
If you call synchronous read or write on the request or response streams, it will explode.
I told this story last week, didn't I? Did I tell this story last week, John? Where we tried to disable async IO, synchronous IO in Kestrel in 2.0. I went on this rant.
2.1, yeah.
And then we found all these problems in the framework that meant we couldn't do it. But we're doing it for real this time.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's on
now.
Yeah.
Cool.
Client server streaming, pipelines everywhere. So in Signaler, I want to show this demo actually. Do we have time?
Yeah. I mean, it's a loose hour.
Oh, good, because we started late, so that counts, right?
Sure.
Okay, yeah. So we had a blog post about, I think, preview 2 of ASP.NET Core, and we showed a demo of streaming. And so I'm going to show this demo now that our dev wrote.
This is streaming from Signaler clients to the server.
Yes.
As opposed to like calling a method many times and chunking it up yourself.
You
can now just say, send this stream.
So
I'm going to send you more data.
Yeah, so before you could do that, right? You could call a method over and over with different chunks and manage that yourself. Or what you could do, so I think this application, I believe we blocked the build but never posted the source code for it. The source code will be coming out soon. We have to code review it and make it all beautiful. So here's my stream. I can watch the stream over here. Wow. Isn't that cool? No one's like saying anything. You guys should be super impressed.
I'm deeply impressed.
Oh, good.
This is Brady's thing, right?
Brady's thing. Brady showed it.
Did you make this?
No. I spent more time trying to figure out how to use the CAM APIs and the dev on our team. Brennan
figured
out.
Talk we gave a build last year where we were adamant not to use jQuery.
Yeah.
And we spent more time futzing around with this.
JavaScript. jQuery
instead. Did you use to turn the frames into ASCII?
Okay, so the way this works is we use the camera APIs on the client side, and then
we use it for the stand-up, it'd be more reliable.
Wouldn't it be kind of cool?
We'll use the save data header and only send this to people on metered connections.
Whoa, that's how it's
smart.
So this thing turns the image into ASCII art in JavaScript, and then sends ASCII
in chunks.
In JavaScript, all in JavaScript.
That's crazy.
And then it sends the actual like string over the wire in chunks. Mm. So if you look at the source code for this.
And it's still 100 times faster than the horrible
thing
version
that we wrote
last year.
I have no idea how this is so much better than what we
it's
wrote.
It's so
I
much
mean,
better.
Maybe we're just bad devs. So there's a hub called Stream Hub. Is that delayed? It's delayed.
Mine's very much delayed.
Okay. Should I slow down?
Twitch is way faster than the YouTube if you want less delay.
There's a hub called Stream Hub that has the that's not F12. It's a regular hub. It has a class called a stream manager, which is a singleton. So I can list all the streams. So the UI you see where the streams are all listed, where I can watch a stream, is all from this list of streams. There's a callback to watch the stream that returns you a channel reader. In the future, this could be an async enumerable. And then start stream. So we basically start a stream. We call run stream async on the stream manager. And then we just tell everyone, hey, new stream is there. And then we await the stream task. So this run stream async, what it does internally is ignore this crazy logic. This is me trying to prevent risk conditions. It reads the incoming stream as a channel. So in the future, this will all be async enumerable and will be a await for each async. Picture this was for each async in your brains. It reads from the incoming channel and writes to all the other channels. So everyone that has subscribed will get the chunks as they come in. It's basically like doing a broadcast, right?
You said that this would be a good use case for each async?
Yes.
Because someone asked on the stream.
Yes, it's literally, instead of all this stuff.
As opposed to a while, an async wait for there to be an item and then a synchronous
drain
call to get the item. You can just do an async for loop.
Yes.
It's just more terse.
Yeah, so this is the channel API.
Right.
Before async in the removal existed.
Right.
So in the hopefully in preview 3, I'll just change this to be await for each async.
Right.
Blah. So that is the feature of Signaler for streaming. All right, what do I have? Okay, pipelines. Ooh, pipelines in the server. So we've been on this journey, or I've been on this journey personally. Since we added pipelines to the stack, system IO pipelines, I've been trying to figure out how to push it all the way through our APIs. So in 3.0, we finally made the big first step to add it to the HTTP context, the HTTP request and response natively. Mm. So the whole intent of this change is that Kestrel has a buffer pool today, and we have pools all the way up the stack. So we use
a buffer pool is a new primitive, right? There's a lot of people don't know what that is.
Yeah. So we pool buffers to be efficient in the server.
So it's a type, and it's basically a collection of memory.
Yeah.
Objects that represent.
You can think
a
of it as our own GC. So we manage our own memory for buffers in the server for networking.
And this feature will allow you effectively to party in that same pool of buffers.
Right. So the prior art. Before today, what you had to do was our middleware, there were kind of two different islands. There was Kestrel, where things were fast and not allocated. Mm-hmm. And then there was Upstack, which had to allocate because the stream API requires you to pass in a buffer. So the issue was that we were reading buffers ourselves in Kestrel, and then middleware wanted to read the form or parse JSON, and it had to copy the bytes from Kestrel into a different pool to then party on.
Right.
So the intent was, could we somehow expose the buffers directly from Kestrel upstack?
Right.
So literally, if you were parsing the form body, you would get the data as it came from the network.
Right.
And you would just parse it up the wire.
Right. With no copying. Right.
And same for output. For output today, we would allocate memory into a different pool and then copy into Kestrel's pool. So could we somehow expose Kestrel's underlying memory and just write into it and say, like, okay, go now, flush.
Right.
So the pipe APIs were kind of born out of that idea, and then we are now exposing it for the first time in 3.0 on the HTTP request and response, like, directly. So what that looks like, I have this sample here, I hope, somewhere, kind of.
You're building it up, it's great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's what the APIs look like today. Request and response now get these new features. So there's a context.request.body, which is the stream. Context, let's see if this intelligence will work. Context.request, request.body, which is the actual stream.
That's what it's today, the people
today.
Are using, yep.
And there's the body pipe. And this is the pipe reader, right? Unlike stream, you end up with kind of one side of the equation. So today for a stream, streams are both read and write, and you have to call, you have to check the Boolean. So for example, if I have a body stream, the body stream for a request is only readable, but yet I have write on here, right? So I have to check, you know, can I write before I write?
So I mean, you should.
You should. You
Not
should, right?
Some people. So a lot of people don't.
Yeah. So the design of pipelines is such that you have a different type for each side.
Right.
So for the reader, you have read operations, and for the writer, for the response dot body pipe, you have write operations.
That's so nice and elegant. Here. I quite like that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Maybe.
I'm sure it creates problems also.
Yeah, maybe.
Is there a combined pipe? Is there like a duplex pipe?
Yeah, there's
a thing.
There's a thing. Yes. Yeah.
So do we expose the duplex pipe
soon?
That's planned.
Yeah.
Wow.
For WebSockets.
PVC pipe.
Yeah. PVC pipe.
It's
thank
funny.
You.
Naming this thing super hard, but I won't get into it. One of the interesting design challenges that we had to figure out in 3.0 is with pipelines was you have this type. You have context.request.body, right? Let's do response, dot body, right? People end up doing things like this, memory stream, right? They want to cache the entire response, so they do this. And then things happen, and then like it all works, right?
Yep.
If you introduce this new property on the response, let's so now I replace the body and I call response dot body pipe dot write.
Yeah.
What happens? Like,
I don't know.
Is it not out of sync? Like, is it gone? Like, has it gone crazy? Like, what's going on? So what we do internally is when you set either of the properties, we return you a type that wraps the other type.
We rewire it all for you.
Yeah. So basically, if you set the body to a stream, we'll give you a pipe wrapper over that stream for the body pipe.
That's pretty cool.
And vice versa. So everyone that was doing this before, if our code uses pipes and your code uses streams, it'll still work. Added complexity for us, but I think that was the bare minimum that we had to do to make sure that it was working well for everyone.
And so obviously you get the most performance benefit when you've managed
when
to get a request that is purely pipelines.
Correct.
Like you would be, I'm assuming we're going through the stack and looking at various middleware that we ship and MVC and Razor, and we're trying to make stuff all used be pipeline native as much as possible.
So talking about that, let me show a profile that I ran before. So here is a profile of, can you guys see that? No?
Mm-hmm.
Boom. All right, so this is dot trace, and this is the timeline view because it's probably the only thing I could use to get allocations in a nice UI for now. And I have two examples here. It is the reading forms example with me posting a form that has my name, David, and my age. but I won't say, 32. 32 years old. One in using preview 3 before we pipelineify the form reader, and one after we pipelineified it. So before, I'll open the view and you can see what got allocated. So before, the code did what you would typically do when you were going to read things from a stream. You would use a stream reader. You pass in the stream. You call it read line or read, whatever. And you get data, right? And we actually did use pool memory. So we allocated a bunch of pool memory from a buffer pool for characters and ones for bytes. And we would do that conversion. So I think this was 10,000 requests of a very small form. And we ended up with 96 megs of allocations. And for the most part, I have a bunch of char arrays and byte arrays, and then the strings as a result of those for the form. Just so you know what I actually sent. I actually sent something like this. Name equals David and age. That's 32. That was the entire payload, right? Super small. Turns out, if you use a stream reader by default, with default settings, it allocates a 4K buffer just in case. 4K chars and 4K bytes to do like transcoding and stuff. So let's say you get data from the wire that is like UTF-32 or some other random encoding. We would read the encoding, turn your bytes into characters, parse those characters, and then turn them into strings. So we had kind of a double allocation. So the goal with the new form reader was to take the bytes as they were from Kestrel in place, figure out the where the form body started and ended, and then parse it in place without having to copy at all.
That's pretty gnarly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Super cool. So let me show you the profile like after that. And the interesting thing is it actually does work for all encodings, because what we do is we only need to get the delimiter in the right encoding,
right,
and then scan for it in bytes. So and we take advantage of the vectorized scanning in the framework. So the framework uses intrinsics to scan like massive amounts of bytes
in parallel,
in a very fast way,
in a single CPU operation.
Yes. Yeah.
I remember when we first started looking at that 4.5 years ago.
Yeah, Ben kind of went crazy on the framework and added all these like vectorized operations to string scanning.
Beautiful.
So, like, index of and substring, all those things are vectorized. So it went from 96 megabytes to 17 megabytes. So now,
wow.
Yeah, so this was the biggest. And now we have the strings, and we can't get rid of these because the form interface is dictionary string, right? But all the intermediate data is now gone. There are no bytes, there's no like chars, there's nothing. Because you're literally taking the bytes from Kestrel as they came in place, scanning for some like and sign or equal sign in some encoding, and then taking that entire payload and making a string out of it directly.
Wow.
So this is like this was the first time we saw pipelines like in action. Like after doing all the plumbing work that took like a bunch of like rounds and go arounds and bugs, to seeing this happen, it actually makes me super happy. Super happy.
So you knew you felt it would happen, but you didn't really know until you did it.
Yeah. So this is like seeing it happen like for real. Before it was all like, okay, in theory, if we do all these 5 things and they all connect like this, this will happen. And now we're like super close. I tried doing a JSON example, but the JSON serializer is not ready yet.
Okay.
It's funny. I had this giant list of Pokemon in a JSON payload, and it was
like
90K of like JSON. And the test was to show how people do it today, where we buffer the entire payload in memory. I had a discussion with Demis on Twitter about async deserialization for JSON.
Mm.
What parsers tend to do today, if you look at all the source code for a bunch of parsers, not all of the ones that I've seen, when you call read async on the parser, passing a stream, it copies the entire payload into a memory stream. And then
That's not good.
That's what everyone does. So because it's really hard to write an efficient parser that does async.
Re-entrant parser.
Streaming. Yeah.
So what our parser does in the framework is you can at the lowest level, the parser is built on a reader. So the reader lets you read like strings and ints and numbers from the network from the byte array. And it returns you the current state of where it got to.
Mm.
So it'll say, I parse this much, I use this many bytes, I'm at this position in the sequence. And then your goal is to take that state object and pass it back in with more data
over and over.
So the serializer stores a stack of objects to where it last got. So it basically calls that thing in a loop saying, OK, I have this many objects, I'm this far within this object, resume. So for pipelines, you're literally parsing the bytes as it comes in from cache on the network, and you're making progress without having to buffer the entire thing all at once.
So you, when you say that state object, it passes back to you. Does that include all the objects you're talking about?
So for the lowest level reader, it's forward only, so there's no storage.
I see.
But for the serializer, it has to store the actual object. So it's storing a stack of objects.
So is it effectively like it gives you a cursor
to where you were,
and then it's your job to pass the cursor back when there's more?
Not your job.
I see.
You call serialize deserialize async, and internally, it will do that loop for you.
So I mean, when I say your job, I mean if you own the pipe.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And then it's your job to say, more data available for you. Here's the thing you gave me
last
time.
When you say your job, who do you mean, the user?
So if I'm the pipe person,
all you do is call.
Are you gonna deserialize?
Okay, hang on. So you're the serializer, and I'm the pipe.
Yeah.
So data like
I'm throwing you data
bursting out of me like an alien.
Okay. So in the app, so there's a first class method in the serializer that takes the pipe.
Yeah.
And just does stuff.
Okay. But I'm implementing that. Okay.
But if you're implementing that code,
yes.
Then you're doing that loop.
I see.
Yeah. So for users, you call like deserialize from stream.
And the serializer is reading from me. Like you're reading from the pipe saying,
yes,
give me the next token or thing.
And the thing is, it can make progress. That is the big deal. Like, actually make progress and get somewhere.
It'll effectively keep reading while there is data until it hits a mark that makes sense for a serializer. Like I read a number, or I read a comma, or a brace, or whatever.
So it won't go sub. Token.
Okay.
So you can't like parse half of the string,
right?
And stop and start. I mean, we could.
If you get to the point where the pipe says, "I got no more data," and you're like, "Well, I'm in the middle of a string. I'm expecting it just yields effectively and says, "Well, but
which call?"
When I say no more data, I mean there's more coming. I just don't have it yet.
Yep.
And so it yields, and that point there's no thread in use. It's unblocked.
Right.
That's the whole benefit.
Yeah. And the beauty is your sync and async code in the serializer is the same code.
Interesting.
The only difference is the outer loop to get more data.
I see.
So the other approach that is taken in JSON.NET is the entire thing is async.
Okay.
Like you use task or by your task all the way down.
All the way through.
That affects performance like dramatically.
I see.
And if you think about it, the async state machine does this for you, right?
Right.
It has state. It yields that state. It's stored in the state machine, but you're paying that cost at a very granular level, where every method in the call stack is async.
I imagine though, retroactively fitting async into an existing serializer, it probably would be cheaper to do it that way than to build an entirely new parser that has its polarity inverted effectively.
Yes, correct.
Right? Okay, so it makes sense that an existing XML serializer, JSON serial, whatever, when it wants to support async, would go, well, I guess I'm going all async all the way through on my existing parsing logic rather than let me build a new serializer and deserialize it. Okay.
And watch the perf tank.
Right.
You talked about some of the optimization, like using. Are you using like the pop count and all that kind of stuff?
Yes.
Awesome. So it's all CPU accelerated where available.
Yeah. There's some code in cache that counts for some reason counts the number of like set bits in a byte. I'm gonna use that. I'm gonna use pop count for that.
That's so cool that those CPU instructions are just there and it's like binding it up. I remember watching those pull requests like right when you guys were first starting to
tweak
Kestrel. It's like, when is it going to hit? So that's.
I remember when Lou was first looking at those methods. He was like, the dot product was paralyzed.
Lou figured out how to use it to do parsing.
Yes.
And then we figured out that dot product was not vectorized.
Was not. And we went,
And it was slower. And we were like, oh.
Oops.
Oops.
And so we had
Did
to do
those happen? I wonder if those work, like if I'm using app service. Does the hosting?
Yeah,
I mean it does. Except that you've already app service is interesting because it's a PaaS. There are other layers that you don't control, and so you can make your stuff as efficient as you like. But if you're running in process hosting, it doesn't matter. In process ASP.NET Core, and it doesn't really matter because you're not using Kestrel. If you're using out of process, you're using Kestrel, so your process is as efficient as it can be. But it's already going through IIS on that same machine. Because it's out of proc, and it's already gone through IIS on the front end through their load balancer, which is IIS as well.
I want to show one more thing.
Your process will use less memory.
I want it to be GPU accelerated, so just give me a call.
Go for it.
When that happens.
So here's an allocation profile I took, and I think it was a million requests or something, maybe.
Sorry, there is one question before we move on. Michael is asking, I think David kind of alluded to it, but there's very little backtracking involved in the JSON serialization? Deserialization?
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. There's basically none. It's forward only. Yeah, because we're reading from a pipe.
Yeah. So either it consumed the full token.
Yes.
Or it didn't.
Right.
So let's say you had a string that was like 10k, and you got 5k of the string.
Mm-hmm.
it would, bytes consumed would be zero.
Right.
It wouldn't like parse half and like resume. It would say like, I didn't parse anything.
Right.
And then you give it the data, you give it the 5K plus whatever you got that came back after okay. that data.
And it, but it's not to say that someone couldn't build a backtracking supporting parser with yep. pipelines. You just have to buffer it yourself.
Yourself, yeah.
Because you have to mark it consumed.
Yes.
And you can look ahead
you can.
In pipelines and just not mark it consumed right? And then it will not release it. It'll still be there for the next recall. So yep. you could still do some
you
things.
You can build some cool,
you can
yeah,
build,
some cool things like that.
Okay, cool. Hope that helps, Michael.
Yeah. So this is an allocation profile. I believe it is a million requests. I want to say it's a million. It's Hello World. It should be this application that disappeared.
Yeah, we used to be able to count the requests because there'd be a bunch of objects that had a
dot
million
memory.
Instances if it was a million requests. But then
it'll
we removed
soon.
All the allocations.
It'll work soon.
And so now we don't have anything to count.
This is true, actually. Oh, my gosh. This might actually affect... Oh my god!
Makes it difficult to see how many requests there have been.
So this is the benchmark. It just does hello world, and it cheats and turns off logging because logging adds some overhead.
Right. But to be fair, all of our benchmarks turn off logging.
They do
because that's what the Tech Compile tells us to do.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they ran out of server space because they forgot to turn off logging.
And there's 4.5 megs of allocations, and most of it is strings and gray user code. If you look at this graph, it has small object heap and large object heap. And on the small object heap, all we have are pretty much strings. And the strings at this point, if you look at the call stack to see where they're coming from, they're all coming from headers. This is a header key, this is a header value. And this is because our headers are represented as string values. So,
you go context.request.headers, and there's like a dictionary basically.
Yeah.
And that is pre-populated by the time you even get to write code, run code that says,
what about
look
UTF-8
at the
header. String?
Yeah.
There we go.
What about that? Yeah.
Or what about lazy header evaluations?
I'll tell you what. We are looking, or we looked at changing string values to support storing bytes in the backing store. Today the backing store is string or string array because headers can be multi-valued. For the most part, the header keys are like reused completely. Because they're known keys, like content
right.
length,
right.
Like, those are all reused. It's
but
the
a lot
values
of values
that
could be reused too, right?
Well, they're intact,
In theory, the values could be, some could be reused, but then you're talking about pooling strings
right.
across
but
where.
We do effectively pool the ones we know about ahead of time. So we have hard-coded strings for known header names.
For keys.
For
names.
For names, sorry.
The values
I thought
not
we did it
all.
For values for like, I thought we did it for the ones that repeat themselves on every request that like no one differentiates.
Where do you put those?
Yeah, no.
They could be stored.
I mean, they'd be literals,
they could be
right? And then you'd have to map them, and if it maps, then you just say it's that one.
You'd pool, and then you'd have a pool that has like a lock, and then.
Other servers do this, by the way.
Yeah, so
this is what
we haven't figured out this part yet, but I mean, this is pretty good.
Yes.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
I'll give you a B plus.
How awesome would it be? Because the platform test. As we talked about before, it doesn't give you a structure that contains headers. It gives you a callback that says, I came across a header while parsing. What do you want to do? Right? And so there's no allocation. You get to decide. In this stuff, we do it all for you.
Yep.
And so to change this, we effectively have to go to a world where the type that we give you that represents headers would have to be lazy. It would
not
have to be
yet.
Not there yet. We would have all the markers because we've parsed the requests. We know where they start
but
and stop.
But there's a whole class of solution and people that will never ever look at the headers.
Oh, of course
so
not. And you could
gloss.
There could be
you're
a flag.
Gloss over them.
And there could be a flag
there
that's like
that we have to read, like the host header. We have to read
over
like
flag.
And you could have a flag that was like pre-read headers or not. But
it would require like having a read headers async API.
Yes.
Like
we have read form async.
Yeah.
And it
and
does.
And then it would do validation. And then like you'd get errors that happen lately.
Yep.
Yeah, that requires API changes.
To be fair, you could, in theory, validate headers, parse and validate headers, but just not materialize them into a string.
Yeah, and then there's the downside of holding the memory that could be used for other requests.
Yes.
So it's kind of a trade-off. So you could imagine, I think the most efficient thing maybe would be to have the header be a big block.
Yes.
And then return you slices when you ask for slices.
Right.
Because trying to return like,
and when you say held
pieces.
On, the reason it's held on is because now you're attached to the pool.
Yes.
Whereas once we've turned it into a string for you, put it in the collection, it's marked consumed.
It's copied, right?
By the pipeline. And so then that part of the pool once that chunk that was, you know, there's obviously more memory in a given chunk that was being, that header might have been consuming. But once that's freed up, even though you might still be processing that request, you may not have even read the header yet. It's in the collection, but that part of memory gets put back into the Kestrel pool and used for the next request. If we do this, it can't, because it hasn't been consumed yet. We need to go somewhere, and it would stay in the pipe. That would be the obvious thing to start with. It would just stay in the part of the buffer that is being rented effectively to the pipe right now.
Today we call your middleware after we've parsed the headers in the start line.
Right.
You can imagine us calling it before parsing headers.
Yeah.
Do start line, and then we say,
there it is, go for it.
And then you have to call back into us to resume parsing.
My gut feel is that we will get there. Eventually there will be a mode or an API you can call an ASP.NET call very early on, or there'll be some way that you'll be able to say, I want to go into this super preemptive lazy, and there's caveats. If you do this mode, some things can go, and you do something strange, the weird thing's going to happen. But I think we'll end up having to get there, because there will be certain scenarios where you want the beauty of using middleware that's just so nice to use, but you also want every absolute ounce of memory control. So I think we'll get there. I don't know if we'll get there in 3.0.
No.
Probably not.
No.
But yeah, we've done pretty well so far.
There's a new type in .NET Core 3.0 that makes it easy to use pipelines called a sequence reader. It's also heavily optimized. It's used to parse bytes in memory. Mm. It does all the hard things about having more than one buffer. Because so for pipelines, you call read async. If you go over a certain size, normally you get buffers split across multiple chunks, like a linked list of buffers. And parsing that is hard, right? So people do two array and they allocate, and it's bad, right?
This virtualizes
it. It kind of defeats the purpose of having that type be abstracting the actual multi-segment buffers. So the sequence reader, you create over a read-only sequence, and you can kind of do give me a line, give me a string. So under the covers, it's doing all the craziness to is it one buffer? Is it n buffers? Do I split across those things? But the API is nicer to use.
Nice.
And we use it in the form reader and now in the HTTP parser.
Right.
And we actually got performance gains from using it in the parser, because the devs spent tons of time. Jeremy and the .NET team spent a lot of time
optimizing,
looking at assembly and making it really fast.
Awesome.
It's really good. Can I show the hot reload stuff? I mean, I guess we're almost.
This is probably the last demo.
The last thing, yeah.
I'm going to have to jet. I've got a meeting in a few minutes.
Okay. You have a meeting, Scott?
I have a job here at the company. Yeah, I've got a bunch of stuff I'm working on. Sorry. I got a meeting in 6 minutes, and I got to get something to eat, or I'm going to die.
Yeah. All right, last demo. Last demo is pretty cool, I hope. Maybe. So, .NET Watch. I've seen a bunch of complaints about .NET Watch being slow to use, and it actually is really slow to use and hard to use in certain cases. And in ASP.NET Core 3.0, we've removed runtime compilation by default from Razor pages. So if you change HTML, you have to rebuild the entire project to rerun to get new bits, right? That's kind of cumbersome, especially if you came from a dynamic language or have been using JavaScript or Node or PHP or something else, where you're basically compiling on demand. So you change a file, you hit F5 in the browser, you have new content, right? Mm-hmm. And so I remember doing DNX all those years ago. That was kind of one of our big things, runtime compilation. You can change
inner loop.
Your C# file and have it reboot. So the question is, can we somehow regain the glory of DNX while using .NET and MS Build and all that stuff? Yep. So I have this experiment where today, .NET Watch, you boot it up, it launches. So you do .NET Watch and some command. So you do .NET Watch run. And that would basically run the code, wait for a file change, and then if the file change, rerun that command over and over.
It's basically coordinating processes by watching for changes at the file system level.
Correct.
Right.
So thinking about this from a zoomed up point of view, the way to get the best experience where you change something in the application and you hit refresh and it just worked is you want to figure out how to be the least destructive you can be when you make changes, right? So if I change a controller, do I need to reboot the entire app? Do I need to kill the process? How far do I have to yield before those changes can be observed by the runtime, right? So anything that happens per request will get recreated per request. So for those things, you could potentially update that one thing and get a new version of it. Mm. If you change the startup class or the program main, guess what? You got to torch the entire application.
It's like thinking in one of those time travel movies, like how far back in time do I have to go in order
to fix
this ripple?
Don't
this
step temporal, on the butterfly.
Exactly.
Flashpoint.
Right? And so you can imagine there's a series of concentric circles here where the innermost circle is the process. And like if you touch anything in there, we have to kill the process and start again. And then there might be the host with the DI container with things that are a singleton lifetime. And then after that, it might be, things in the DI container that have a lifetime other than singleton. Right. And then after that, it might be, things that are like request per request. Like now, unfortunately, things like the middleware pipeline sound like they're per request, but they're actually evaluated once up front and the pipeline is built like in the beginning, so today. And then all the way out to like a Razor view. Today, Razor views a separate assembly. So like that's really easy to just like, I'm not the other one in theory. And we do that already in pre-3.0 apps.
Yep. So today in Razor, we compile a different assembly with a random name. And it's easy because when a request comes in, we can say, has the file changed on disk? If it has, recompile via Roslyn, get a new assembly, return it to the caller. Right? That's super easy. For .NET Watch, it's a little bit trickier because depending on what change was made and you're trying to save state, you want to not be destructive. So that requires knowing what content is in each file, what kind of file is being changed, what's going on, right? So this sample is trying to give an experience that's kind of like in IIS, where I make a file change. If I make a request during the app teardown state, I want the request to be queued until the app has spawned again. Today in Watch, if you're in between a change and in the browser, it'll give you there's no socket listening.
Yeah, it gives you the worst error, which is I couldn't even make a connection.
Exactly. So you want to separate the server from the actual like application process.
Right.
So what this thing does, what this crazy hack does, it's a crazy cool hack, I think. There's a server running in Watch. So Watch has a server running, and it's running Kestrel, right? So it reads settings, it knows Kestrel things, right? Then we boot up a second, so let me show the application structure. In this demo, the watcher is basically .NET Watch. And the sample is the actual application. So the sample looks pretty normal. There's no tricks here, right? And the watcher runs, and it says, I'm going to point to that DLL. So I'm hard coding a path to the sample application. So you can imagine it being .NET Watch, this folder, and it would just like know that.
Right.
Then the watcher has a server running in itself.
Okay.
So it's running Kestrel. And it's going to boot the application in a different context, assembly load context, which is a new thing in .NET Core
3
that tries to be like app domains without the app domain APIs or boundaries.
So the watcher is effectively in proc now.
Yeah, so the watcher is in the same process as your application.
Right.
So you're loading the application like a plugin into the host process. And the host process owns the server, so you're telling, you're basically getting the application, the middleware pipeline from the plugin, and running it in the host process. So this code, what it does is it says, get me the required service hosting server, which is my type. So the server is actually, we put a fake server in the ASP.NET Core app in the child process, so we can actually get a handle on the request, right?
Right.
So, and then I call wait for application async.
In the child context.
In the child context. And this wait for application async will basically wait until the application is spun up and ready before requests get let through. Mm. And this handles the queuing for us. In the back, I actually built this using all of our primitives. So I have a background service that basically has this super long loop that says, okay, I'm gonna watch for CS file changes. And while the app is still running, I'm gonna create a load context, pointing at the application, and then I'm gonna load that assembly in that context. So I'm actually loading the app assembly in this child load context, and the whole intent is that we're gonna unload the application whenever it changes, right? That's possible now in ASP.NET Core.
Yeah, someone just asked, so unloading is finally done?
Yes.
And I said, yes.
Yeah, it works.
And it's now done.
The way it works is things get GC'd, so if your load context for some reason reaches out into like the host context and holds onto an object, it won't get cleaned
up. So it's tracked like objects.
It's tracked like objects.
Tracked. Yeah. Okay.
We call into the create host builder method. So this method in main, in the child application, we actually call into create default builder. What Damien loves.
I'm trying to get rid of that method.
We call it via reflection.
Fowler depressed me. Like he, I went on some rant to him the morning before this prototype, and I'm like, I want to get rid of that method because our program mains look different to every other console app program main because there's this other
method,
weird method with a name with no attribute or interface. It's like you have to have it there or stuff doesn't work properly. And there's not even a comment that tells you why we have that there. Yeah. It just kind of bugs me. And he's like, yeah. So I built a prototype that uses that method, and that's what we need in order to make this really great reload experience. I'm like, ah, crap. Yeah. So with some work to do. This is a prototype.
Yeah,
it's a proof of concept. And then we need to do some more work to make it real.
So we call create default builder. We call into the actual method. We get the applications host builder. This type actually exists in the child context. One thing that's interesting about load context is you can't do type exchange. It'll just tell you I can't cast type A to type A. So let's say I loaded JSON.NET in the child context and in the host context. And then I passed a JSON.NET instance from the host to the child context to an API. It would say I cannot cast blah to blah, and you'd be like, huh? So there's still a bunch of things to figure out to make the context look better in the debugger and stuff. Because you can't distinguish two types from different load contexts like easily. It's really hard to figure out.
I guess it's not dissimilar to, like, technically you can load the same assembly of different versions twice in .NET framework today, even in the same app domain if you try to do
same,
it.
So it's funny. So this load context concept exists in everywhere.
Right.
They're exposing it now. So it's always been there. It's always been internal. So if you call load bytes, you get a different context. If you call load file, you get a different context. If you call load, you get a different context. Implicitly. But in this world, it's like I have an object as a context,
right.
Load it into that thing.
Okay.
So you're being explicit. We sneak our server object into the application server, so it thinks that the server it's starting is kind of our server, right? The whole server.
Mm.
And that tells us when the application has started and it's ready. So we start the application host. This is an iHost builder. We wait for a file change. And by the way, I wrote it this way because it gave the code a very linear flow. It says start application, wait for file changes, stop application. Mm-hmm. This is a funny bug. It crashes the process when it call collect. don't even ask me why. And then it runs .NET build, no restore, and then it goes again. So this loop just runs over and over, right? And you end up getting that experience where, I'll just show you.
So now the slowest part is waiting for the app to rebuild after you've had a change, because that's not in proc or anything. Like, DNX did really crazy stuff. But this, at least, you don't pay the cost of booting the app process every time.
Every time.
And we haven't gone as far as like that concentric circle thing we talked about where we could, like, if you just change a controller,
that's
we
next.
Just do that. But you're going to try that next, I guess.
I'll talk about it next. So let me show you a sample. So
we don't have an awful lot of time now.
I know. Yeah, almost so. Done. No, I won't show up. I'll talk about it.
Okay.
Hello World 2. I'll make a change. Hit save. It rebuilds. Jesus, that's slow. Okay, let me just, Hello World 2 is there. Let me try again. Hello world. I'll hit save. It should build faster now. If I refresh in between the changes, like three, if I refresh here, I'll hit save and refresh. It should queue the request until it happens.
So Michael's asking, are load contexts like their own stack? They're hierarchical. So if I load a load context from inside another load context, which is inside another one, they kind of, like, is it going to be turtles?
There's no stack, no.
Okay. So it's not turtles all the way down.
I think they're all rooted at the parent.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's no nesting. I think it's just.
So you can't have like a plugin that loads its own plugin.
You can,
but you'd have to track that separately.
When you implement a load context, and whenever someone calls load on that load context, you have to decide where it came from, where that load request gets served from. So you can say, I got a load callback. I want to load it into this context or load it from the default context.
Okay.
So you can kind of like.
But the default is one.
Yeah.
And then you're saying if the default load context loads another one, like one under it, and then that runs some code that creates a load context.
Don't think of it as
I implement a load context.
Yes. And someone has to call load on that load context.
Can I have multiple implementations of load context running in the same app at the same time?
Yep.
And then how does the coordination between whose callback gets called work?
Whoever, so it's interesting. Whoever triggered the initial load,
yes,
should get all the requests. And then you can choose to redirect it to a different load context in your implementation.
So it would have to be cooperative, I guess.
It was, yes, exactly.
Okay.
So the only wildcard is assembly.load has to figure stuff out, right?
Yeah.
Where'd it come from? Okay. And today it's broken.
Yeah, so Michael's just commenting he thought he heard it differently, which is you had said, oh, you load a new assembly, a new context is returned. David was talking about the internals before we expose this, and that internally, when you loaded an assembly, load from bytes versus load from file, whatever.
Those internally have their own.
The bookkeeping that the runtime was doing to track what assemblies were being loaded from
where
was done via this thing called a load context, and sometimes it would create a new one.
Right.
It wasn't that you actually get back the load context or anything like that. And when he says now exposed, we're not giving you back, you implement it. I guess it's a little bit like implementing, what was it, appdomain.handle, there was like a type loaded or assembly loaded event
something? The weird thing about it, it's super weird. So like, there was always the default context, which was the GAC and the bin folder.
Okay.
So things that were in the probing paths were loaded in the default context. So that it got all the benefits of unification, all that stuff happened by default, right? If you call load file, you were in a different context, just like a different one altogether.
And your type was a different thing to the one that had a same name, same identity. It was just different.
Different type.
Okay.
And same for load from bytes.
Okay.
So you couldn't like cross the stream from those things.
They were isolated by definition.
Different universes, right? So either your plugins would be all from file. That's how things kind of work. You would load it all from file or all from somewhere else, right? And then for shared dependencies like object, those would come from the default context. So you kind of have to create your own like layering in that sense. Where if you have a system, you want the host to be in the default context because it's shared.
Yes.
Anything you want to share across your child context needs to be in a shared context somewhere else.
Okay.
And then you pass the instance from that host into different contexts.
It sounds like I think seeing a sample of how a plugin system that allows other things to load that have their own plugins, that would be a good, I think I need to see that to really understand.
I'll put it in a link in the show.
All right, cool.
Okay, so this is pretty much done. I'm just gonna show the demo again. So hello world 3, I make a file change, I hit F5, it's in between reloads, it loads again. So that shows the queuing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
In the old watch, it would have just like said no server.
It looked pretty quick too.
Yeah. So on the left here, there's the DMS build happening. So if you look, where's my VS Code? If you look over there and I do hello world, boo.
And of course, build in .NET Core 3 F5. From the CLI should be faster than build in CLI 2, I hope,
should
SDK.
Be.
I mean, but we did a lot of work in SDK 2.1 and 2.2, and there's now like the VBCS compiler.exe is cross-platform, which shares compilation information between Roslyn invocations or the compiler invocations. We have the MS build node thing, multi-node, whatever the hell it's called.
Node reuse.
So we'll create like a separate MS build process per core.
Store state,
And just store state. And they persist across invocations of build. And so all that stuff has new since .NET Core 1 and .NET Core 2. And so I mean, that's continually being refined to make things like call build on this app that you just built a moment ago as fast as possible. Or build this app, this project that references 47 other projects and have it be as efficient by only knowing what I have to rebuild last time and all that type of stuff.
So we're looking at things like edit and continue to try to figure out if we can do something like
that old nugget.
Yeah, you change the controller and we know the controller isn't destructive change.
There's like a holy grail that we're aware of, right? Yeah. It's like you could imagine your app doesn't have to restart at all. The process is running and you just like change a variable, a default value, right? And you just want the app to do the bare minimum. Oh, that's a bad example. How about I change the first line of an MVC controller action method, right? Because that's per request, and there's nothing you can really get into danger with there. How do we make that the fastest minimal change to the running application possible? Now, that's hard with .NET, and there's really two mechanisms that exist today that address very specific scenarios. One is the profiler, where there's a hook that lets you basically give it new IL, as I understand
Regit.
And you can say, regit this method. And it's a method level, a member level or something. You can say, change this method to this now. And the runtime will like do the needful and coordinate that and dispatch, update vtables and all the rest of it, right? And then there's edit and continue, which requires a debugger to be attached. And then there's some intrinsic via iCore debug or something that lets you do that.
Yeah, so in Rosin, you can create a diff assembly. So given a base and given these changes, give me a diff assembly.
And that assembly is used by the edit and continue mechanism, as I understand it, to say, oh, this is a diff, and it'll do something.
Yep.
The runtime
That's
does
the
something.
Yeah.
But today, that requires the debugger to be attached. Yeah. I would love for us to get to the point where that edit and continue style experience works just with like launching.
With watch, right?
With watch. And then somehow there'd be a way for the assembly to be created in the most efficient way possible. And then you can like feed it into the app, which would probably be something like this, because you've got a load context, so you can just unload assemblies or say apply this diff assembly.
Yep.
And it's all just as quick as possible.
And the hard part is figuring out when to apply which level of change.
Yeah. Like, and anyone who does SPA development will know that a lot of the SPA JavaScript frameworks went through similar like hot reload scenarios.
They're all slow though, aren't they?
They're all fairly, and the reason they do it, right, is because they have quite complicated build infrastructure usually. And if you were just to make a JavaScript file, like, it's not, you know, it's your JavaScript, it's TypeScript or something else. You make that file, you make that change, and then you wonder, like, you'd have to rebuild the entire app and then navigate back to where you were in your complicated SPA hierarchy to do so. And that's the same reason why, you know, XAML apps and WinForms, they all have the same issue. And edit continue is very common in those type of apps because it's not request-based. Like, there is only state, and then that is held in the process. And if you kill it all, you have to go all the way back to where you were in the app to fix the bug, you know, to try to see if you fix the bug again. So,
or maybe we do an interpreter. No.
Well, that's a reason. That's something else
like
that things do. And Blazor has an IL interpreter today, but they don't do hot reload yet.
Yeah.
So, but that's, I know of other .NET, mini .NET flavors. People have built interpreters in order to feel like the Mono has an interpreter, and that's used in some of the Unity scenarios, right? The other .NETs. So, yeah. Lots of options, but this is a cool thing to see. All right, we are like way but we had
only 45 minutes.
We're extracting all.
You know, I'm happy. I've been
only 45 minutes.
We've been trying to line this up for a while. So
this is no storm, man.
There are a couple of questions. We could do rapid fire, like 1 minute.
Sure.
Whatever happened to Magma?
Oh, I think it is pretty much dead now.
Okay, Magma's dead.
Everyone got bored.
Okay. Have we looked at HTTP3 and Quick?
Yes.
I was going to say, all that performance stuff you talked about, a lot of it is a benefit in HTTP 1.1. We haven't, not all of that applies equally to HTTP 2.
Which ones?
A lot of the stuff you talked about. Because a lot of the time you talked about things like, we now make this a singleton.
The reuse?
Yeah.
It's still there.
I guess it gets reused a different way.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fair enough. Because so you can have more than one request.
I haven't done the work yet, but we plan to, so we have a max number of HTTP 2
streams
per connection,
right,
and we'll pool those.
Okay.
Then it'll be the same.
So in an HTTP 1.1 connection, there will literally only have to be one request object now,
right,
or one response object at a time, because you have one request at a time anyway,
right,
or being processed, at, even if it's pipelined. But because in HTTP 2, it's multiplexed, you could have N requests.
200.
The idea is that you'll pull them and only create them when you need to, and then you know, cut them away and stuff and all the way. Okay, cool. And then HTTP 3 and Quick, we have no plans for 3.0. It's still super new.
No. So there's probably maybe like one or two actual valid implementations.
Okay.
The Quick that exists in like the browser for like Chrome and stuff, or is the old Quick, the one that isn't the actual spec Quick before the spec was done, right?
Right.
We've been working with the Windows team on Quick like for about a year now, actually. They're part of the IETF, I think.
Group.
ETF.
One of them.
That's right. Yeah.
Yep.
We actually are involved, like not me, but like the company, Microsoft, are involved in the spec and like implementation. We have a library internally that is used by like some teams.
Okay.
So we have to figure out how to get into .NET as a first class thing. First, the Quick support as like a Quick socket or something in .NET.
Yep.
And then once that's done, HTTP.
Okay.
HTTP3 support in Kestrel.
Okay, two more questions. MQTT, there was a prototype at some point floating around that you wrote that did MQTT. Does it still work?
So there's a guy called Jan, I can't remember his last name. He actually has a library called MQTT Lite, or he contributed, I think, that code to a project, a real project.
Okay.
I think it's called, let's see, MQTT Lite.
And it plugs into Kestrel?
Yeah, it uses Bedrock. It uses a connection handler stuff.
So there you go.
And
so it's not part of our stack, but you can use this thing that's built on our stack.
Where is it? I'll find it.
Okay. MQTT, a thing.
Let me see if I can find this thing.
I'll give you 10 seconds.
8, 9.
While that, I'll answer the last question.
Yep.
Someone asked, when will we see preview 3?
Never.
My hope is this week. They're literally trying to get it released right now.
Yeah,
it might be today, for all I know. I'm not in that meeting because I'm here instead. So we'll see.
Ah, here it is.
All right, so there it is. MQTT.
Someone has posted in
there. Oh, someone posted it. Is this the one?
Yeah, MQTT, looks like same one.
That's excellent. All right.
Very cool.
We're done.
Is it possible, David? Is it possible for you to post some of your stuff in a gist or something? We can share that out.
Yeah.
Well, there's also someone commented early on saying, "Can David make a GitHub repo like he did for the diagnostic stuff for all this performance stuff?" And I told him that you and Ben are actually doing that. Hasn't started yet.
Oh, right.
But that is the plan. And Dave and I have been talking about turning a bunch of this stuff into new talks, maybe even a workshop. So we were talking about maybe making a diagnostics workshop to talk about the diagnostic stuff we did our talk on. But then we could do a performance workshop, two-day workshop or something. And we could record it, we could do it at conference or whatever. It's just a lot of work for us. But we would love to do it because, you know, sharing this stuff is cool and a lot of people are obviously interested in it, so.
Cool. For people still watching, which is still a lot of people, it's almost 300.
Really?
If you're on Twitch, we're going to do a raid. We're going to try this raid thing.
What's a raid?
A raid is where you keep watching. It's a party that just keeps going. And so if you're interested in PowerShell, I'm not very good at PowerShell, but I keep trying. We're gonna raid. Chrissy is streaming on PowerShell.
Okay.
PowerShell Live.
Interesting.
So. Cool.
All right.
Very quickly, a couple of people are asking related questions about LTS. 2.1 is the current LTS release. It'll be supported through till, I think it's June 2021 at a minimum. 2.2 will not be LTS, it is on the current train. And 3.0 at this stage will not be an LTS. We're still determining whether we'll do a 3.1 that'll be LTS, which I think is most likely, or whether it'll be some release after that. I do believe we're gonna try and firm up those plans and do a blog post or something in the next, you know, before we release 3.0 GA to say what the LTS plans are. But I can say there will be no 2.2 or 2.x LTS. 2.1 is the LTS release for that train. And for the 3.0 itself will not be an LTS release. It will be a current. So if you're on 2.2 today, and this was said in the blog post when 2.2 came out, this is not news. If you move to 2.2 as the current train, you'll need to move to 3.0 when it comes out within the grace period, which is, I think, 3 months. In order to get the support and servicing releases after that grace period is up. Now, moving from 2.2 to 3.0, there are, you know, a bunch of small breaking changes, but moving an application, we've got lots of feedback from customers that actually moving an application is very straightforward.
3.0?
For 3.0.
Oh, good.
And it depends on what you use, like always, but most of the, you know, quote-unquote breaking changes that we've made, in ASP.NET Core at least, a lot of them are around the startup stuff with generic hosting. A lot of that is mostly compatible. And there isn't that much that is like, oh, we changed this API, we got rid of it, that was widely in use.
So we did remove deprecated APIs.
We removed stuff, and that, again, that was pre-announced, that was always going to be the case. If you're using an API that's already marked obsolete in 2x, it will be gone completely in 3.0. So first step, stop using all the obsolete APIs because they always get removed in the next major version with the .NET Core plans. And that's true for the stuff under the stack as well, and EF Core as well. So all those things, we kind of all adhere to the same policy. So, all right, let's go. Time to leave.
All right. Do we dramatically
we could go forever, but no, I just have to hit the button. So we'll say bye, and I can't wait to have you on again. It's been too long.
Four more
Everyone,
years.
Like, we have 300 people watching.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so anyway, well, we'll catch you later, everyone. Bye.